Welcome to another episode of the Uphill Athlete Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Johnston, co-founder of Uphill Athlete. These podcasts are just one of the many free resources we offer to inform and inspire mountain athletes. Today, I'm joined by David Gottler, fresh back from an ascent of Mount Everest without the use of bottled oxygen. When I say fresh, I mean it. The man was on the summit 1 week ago today. David is a member of the North Face athlete team, a professional mountain guide, and an accomplished alpinist. He's been coached by me for about 6 years now, and we've been using the exact same well-tested training methods that you found in the books and in the training plans that we sell. You can take some heart that they've been well-proven. Today, we're going to discuss some things about his mental preparation, how that was different this year than in previous years. Also going to talk about how important it is to be able to embrace the suffering in order to succeed in this kind of a climb. We're going to talk his use of intermittent hypoxic training in his preparation. Also, a new approach that he used this year for his acclimatization program, and it seems to have set him up really well for success. So these and many other topics come up in the first conversation we've had since he arrived home in Spain just 24 hours ago. I hope you enjoy the chat. Thanks. Welcome home.
Thank you. Yeah, feels good to be home. And actually, I mean, I spent half the day on the couch sleeping.
And when did you get there?
I got yesterday, back home. Yeah. So kind of from on top of the summit fatigue comes now the travel and jet lag fatigue. So yeah. It's kind of like, it's a pretty kind of empty space I am at the moment. But it feels good to be back home, and especially in sick kind of sea level air here in northern Spain, which is really nice. Yeah. And humid. And because this time I somehow didn't manage to don't get the kind of Kumbu cough or the high altitude cough, and it's pretty bad this time.
I can hear it. I can hear a little bit of the Kumbu cough.
I might already kind of say sorry for the listeners who kind of have to listen to my coughing here and there.
Well, thanks for agreeing to join me so soon after you got home. I thought it's great to get to see you and talk to you so quickly after the expedition and the climb. I want to hear all about it. And I'm sure lots of people are interested in hearing how things went for you this year. Sounds like...
I think it's a good opportunity or a good way to do it, because normally we always connect afterwards and then I tell you everything, and then afterwards we do a podcast recording, and doing it the same time I think brings really a lot of fresh and authentic insights to it, and it's might be even easier for us both, that we don't have to stage again this kind of recording and the same questions.
Well, where should we start? Do you want to start at the beginning, like when you arrived there? Or do you want to start from the summit and work backwards? One thing I'm really curious about is the comparison of this year to last year with Killian, and then the year when you got so close to the summit and had to turn around because of the crowds and getting cold. So at some point, I want to have you touch on that kind of comparison.
I mean, I think in general, this comparison thing is a really dangerous topic, which I figured out also. And I was lucky enough that I worked a little bit with, that I worked this year leading up to the expedition with a mental coach, with a friend from Germany who is a professional mental coach. And we touched on that luckily, because exactly it happens that when you have these goals where you go again and again, you start to compare so much from like how you felt the previous year, how you felt the year before, how I felt last time on the on the South Summit, how I felt going running or moving around in the Kumbu. And when the comparison is kind of below the expectations or below what was happening the year before, immediately it kind of can can totally kind of pull you down, like mentally and from the motivation and from like you think like, oh my god, last time it felt so much better and now it feels so, I mean, how can I ever reach my goal this year? And this happens really actually a couple of times. And so this comparison thing is, on the one hand, I it's really good because you kind of compare and you learn and you kind of see what works better, but it's also this kind of dangerous element to it, on these kind of repetitive kind of attempts, and you go again and again and again.
Oh yeah, I can definitely see that. I guess I wasn't meaning maybe so much the performance as just like the overall experience. But I see what you're saying about the performance. And actually, I've with training more traditional athletes, I've known coaches, let's say, who were training runners on the track, and they're doing interval training leading into some important race, and they're slow, and a coach will lie to them with the time, say, oh man, that's so much faster, you're looking really strong. And
I for sure needed sometimes there. I would have needed you sometimes there and say like, actually you're really good right now, that's totally crushing it. And
well, the psychological component of all of these type of sports is I think every bit as important as a physical preparation. And I think especially for these really long duration type events where you're essentially, they're all about suffering, and it's like enduring the suffering, for hour after hour, it's so easy for it to get into your brain. Like, oh, this is terrible. I hate it. It really hurts. I'm going so slowly. And then you can talk yourself out of it. So what do you do? Especially on climbing Mount Everest without supplemental oxygen is going to cause you to suffer a great deal for many hours. Like, what kind of mental games are you playing when that's going on for you?
But I mean, and in general, I kind of are good in embracing this suffering. I mean, everybody who's in this kind of sports, I think this is like one of their big traits, that we kind of can embrace this suffering. And for me, I try to break it down always in these kind of smaller steps. Like, for example, when I go from base camp to camp two, and I just like, okay, now first reaching the crampon point, then like this kind of the part in the ice fall, which I really don't like and which is dangerous. So just concentrate on that and go through that, and don't think about beyond kind of what comes tomorrow, what comes the day after tomorrow when summit day is, and just like now we concentrate and we make it to camp one or beyond this kind of dangerous part, and that's all I'm thinking about. And so for me that works really well to kind of break it down. This is one strategy. The other one is that I always envision myself like what comes after the suffering, like how great the moment must be, like on a summit day, come on, like I know now it's tough, and there were passages later on we can touch on that, which were really, really taking so much energy, like mentally and physically, out of me, just suddenly because the snow changed a little bit, and so I just concentrated, okay, just go to the next point, and then remember how amazing it must be to, once you kind of reach the summit, or once you reach the south summit, from there it might be like really easy, even if I know from there it's again like a really difficult endeavor to get to the main summit, and so on. So I trick myself in these, and then I often also really force myself to just think about something completely else, like let my thoughts kind of go to a totally different area, feel like thinking, and just let over, because the climbing there is often, it's super easy and it's just intuitive, so I can, it's like running in a lot of way, where you don't have to concentrate all the time on the movement. It's not like rock climbing where you are forced to really think about the the movement where you hold and all of this. So you can let your swords also really go to totally different places for a while. And that's also what works really well.
So can you tell us what sort of things that the mental coach helped you with? I mean, I know on the physical side what we've been doing, and we didn't do anything crazy different than we've done in, you know, for the last, what, how many, 6 years or something. You know, every time you've been going off on this kind of a climb, we prepare essentially the same way with only small variations. But this year with the mental coach, that's a whole new element. And, you know, I would assume you found it useful from what you've been saying, but were there some things that the mental coach taught you that you'd like to pass on or you could pass on?
Yeah, for example, like what I said before with this kind of comparison that we said, I really need to try very hard to just stay in the moment. I don't compare it to my previous years, and I just like stay in the moment, stay like, yeah, like be really like just concentrate on the next step, concentrate on the day, and doesn't matter if there's a day which doesn't feel as good as compared to last year, when if my time is slower from base camp to camp two compared to last year or 2019 or something like this, like it's okay. That's like what I have to work with this year, and doesn't matter if it's half an hour later, it doesn't mean that I don't be able to summit. So this was the one thing. The other thing which I have a lot of struggle, or which is my kind of weakness, that I really love to control everything, and I love to be in control of yeah, like you know, from training, I think I'm very structured. I love to keep every training session we put in. I love to execute it exactly. And I'm the guy who kind of, if there's an hour, I run in the end, these 2 minutes around my car to make the hour really full, which is like pointless. But it's like, okay, let's keep it like as structured, as controlled as possible. And then on expedition, you know, you've been yourself, there are so many factors which we can't control, and that I accept this, that I'm okay with it, and especially going back there now the third time, I had the feeling that the pressure from myself is way bigger than before. I was not anymore this kind of innocent kind of first try. You suddenly can fail again. You know that it's very likely that not all puzzle pieces kind of you know like fit perfectly together, and being prepared for that was a huge part of my mental coach kind of work, and it helped me. And I had this for sure. I had this dips when suddenly this year, like it started super early with summiting, and they put the fixed ropes in very early. And a lot of people went like always oxygen, and so you sit there and was thinking like, oh my God, I'm not even ready with my acclimatization, and I would love to go as well, and you need to be patient, and you know, okay, it's on the one side it's good that everybody already goes, but hopefully there's coming this weather window. And then there was this time when I decided, okay, I'm ready, and should I go or not? And in the end, I had the feeling it was more a coin toss of choosing the 21st or waiting for later 25th or 26th and of May for my summit attempt. And I mean, luckily I chose 21st because I couldn't ask for a better day. But in retrospective, I'm almost a little bit scared and afraid, like how close it was that I would have chosen the other day, because I said like, oh, maybe it's actually looked like a better window at one point. So it's this kind of, yeah, like work where I really struggle to kind of, yeah, like give up the control and also accept this kind of uncertainty. And this was really good to work with.
I you are a person I know that likes to control things. And you are a person who likes to, like you said, to run around the car for 2 minutes to make sure you get that hour in. So I can, and the mountains do take that control away from us. There's very little we can control. The one thing we can control is our fitness. And you know, that's the thing we really focus on, because if we have a control over that and we know the fitness is good, at least you can put your mind at rest about that thing and be able to handle the other variations and changes that might come along. But it sounds like this, you know, there was a little bit of luck here, picking the right coin toss.
For sure. There was luck. But I mean, on the other hand, I think also we can control then once we kind of made this decision or we did the coin toss and we started, we can then control like how far we want to push ourselves out there and I saw like this year again in the Himalayas on other mountains as well, where people just don't accept, I think, in a way, the kind of limitation we have there, especially like if we're talking about then to the set of rules we apply ourselves, like if we go without oxygen, if we go without a shepherd support, if we self-sufficient there, and all of this kind of set of rules we choose by ourselves, that in nowadays on these mountains, because they're moving this kind of incredible huge variety of people with different set of rules, and often we get a little bit kind of distracted, I would say, in the way that I see other people, they go without oxygen, for example, no Sherpa, but then they're surrounded by people who go with Sherpa and oxygen, and these people can push way longer. And for myself, I need to be in control, like when I turn around, doesn't matter what's happening around me with other people. And this, I think, gets more and more dangerous and challenging, if you want to say so, on a mountain where like a lot of different styles move at the same time.
I could see that happen. Yeah. And were there any, I haven't heard, were there any accidents this year, any really bad situations that you know of?
No, not ice. On Everest, it was surprisingly, good and safe. But for example, on Annapurna, two guys got really like in massive trouble and got rescued, and they have like massive frostbites and lose their hands and fingers and toes and nose and everything. So, I mean, there were, in general, I had the feeling there were quite some frostbite issues all over the Himalayas, because there were this a lot of, yeah, like because the season started everywhere so early, I think a lot of people were not really ready with their acclimatization, and then the people with oxygen, they already started for their summit go bits, and so the people without oxygen, they were kind of like drawn into that in a way.
Have you seen, now that you've been there three times, have you seen an increase in the number of people that are trying to climb it without the use of supplemental oxygen?
Oh, I think that, like this year especially, there were for sure quite some people who were trying without. And again, here we need to, I would say, difference between this kind of different style without oxygen, and because there were, for example, the day I summited, there were two other guys who tried without oxygen by the head there. They called it their bodyguards with them. So there were Sherpas with them who had like spare oxygen and mask for them, and in case they needed, and they both used it. Because I think this is, it's a quite common thing now to you to try it without oxygen, but have this kind of bodyguards with you, and then you might always, I think almost always fall back to them, because because if you have this kind of temptation so close that you use it, and you have someone who is also really highly interested in giving it to you because they are your guides, and they know if they give it to you, you make Summit and you're way safer. It's you end up in the end using it.
It's kind of like having a top rope. I was teasing someone who's a very well-known climber, well-known to you and me, whose name I won't mention, who wanted to climb Everest with oxygen. And I told him, you know, that's kind of like grabbing the draws.
It is.
But I understand a lot of people still want to do it that way. And as you and I have talked a great deal about this, you know, there's no rules in these sports.
And, exactly. You know,
people make up the rules they want to use, and that's perfectly fine. But it's, you know, people, I think, do need to understand that the rules make a huge difference. Whichever kind of rules you accept or decide to use, that makes a very big difference.
For sure. And this is my kind of, like, you know, I did just a post about it, and I just advocate that we become more honest in it, and that we, like, proactively talk about what things we used on the mountain, what's, because we all who move there know exactly what small pieces make a huge difference in how this kind of achievement comes together. And for example, for me, I stated clearly I use the fixed ropes, which are put up by Sherpas. I use the Icefall Sherpas on oxygen, and I benefit highly from the track, which is always there. I never more or less had to break a trail there on Everest. The fixed ropes, they make it so much safer to get back down the Lhotse face, for example. So I used it. But on the other hand, I carry all my stuff by myself. And that's, again, like, it's such a huge difference. If I come back after the summit bid to the last camp where my tent was, my small single wall tent, I had to start to melt water. I go somewhere, get some ice or snow, melt the water. It takes like an hour to get the water. Then drink something, then put down the tent. Then I went back to camp 3. I pitched it up again in the night. Just to pitching up this tent there, it took me ages. And I was really like, I was crawling because I was so, so tired. And it was, and suddenly I have to force myself every step. I'm kind of, okay, it now put together these two poles, like the inner poles for the tent, put them in. So you put them in, then you're like, oh my God, okay, this is done. Then you crawl in. Then again, you need to start the stove, melt water. If there's a shepherd who has, you know, your hot water ready when you come to a camp, and you never have to take down your tent or put it up, it makes a huge difference. And it's not that one is better or the other. It's just like this, all these pieces add up in the kind of like effort and how seriousness something is going, and this is the only thing I think I would like to that we talk about more honest and open, and don't mention these things, because we know what difference they make.
Yeah, totally. You know, when I think about my experience on K2, and you know that, and now the mountain is guided and ropes are fixed on it. And that's, I mean, it's a completely different experience than it was 20, almost 30 years ago.
Yeah. And I mean, I heard now that for the summer season for K2, they issued 300 permits. I mean, 300 people on K2. Can you imagine? I mean, you know the route there. Like, there's not even the space. I don't know, like, how they will do it
if there were
really 300 people, but it's insane. It completely changes there, and with the kind of amount of people, with the amount of oxygen, the logistics they have there, and still, you know, I don't judge in the way that, you know, for the people who are there, it might be the biggest adventure and the best day in their life if they summit it in whatever way. But I just want that we kind of speak more honestly about the difference in style and not put it always under the same umbrella of like, hey, that's 8,000 meter peak climbing and that's more or less all the same. It's not. It's like completely different disciplines.
Yeah, and that's K2 in particular. Like you said, there's not many very good tent locations, camps.
No, not at all.
There's no flat places.
I'm really happy I stay the summer here in Spain and in the Alps.
And I can't imagine having 300 people go through that Black Pyramid area and not have someone get hurt by the rock wall. It's so dangerous there.
It will be.
It's crazy. Yeah. 300. Like when I was in 1995, when I was there, there had been 100 people summit K2 by 1995, and there had been 50 killed.
Yeah.
So it was a different kind of experience then. But I hope it's safer. Maybe they've knocked all the loose rocks off of that Black Pyramid.
I don't think so. And the bottleneck will be the bottleneck will be the same as well.
Yes.
Yeah, we should.
Anyway. Were conditions similar? Like, I mean, I know that as you do very well, big mountains condition change, obviously, from week to week, day to day. How do the 3 years conditions compare for you? And what did those changes in conditions require you to do?
I mean, the conditions were more or less always the same. And maybe this year they were a little bit better, especially on the, I mean, starting down the Khumbu Icefall was this year, I would say, a little bit more dangerous. And it's really just like a nasty, nasty place where you want to move fast through. The route was maybe a little bit more direct, but there was this huge fields of like popcorn, they always call it. So it's this kind of like smaller but very loose kind of area and pieces which always kind of change, and then the Lhotse face itself was actually, because we had always a little bit of fresh snow, was nicer because it was not so black ice, because I remember 1 year where it was really a lot of black ice, and then it's more tricky. And this year this was quite nice to go. And then the summit bit was changed really from day to day, because I saw from other people who were summiting before that it was all the way really nice and hard. And when I did it the day, the first part was really good to the, but just under the balcony and like a little bit above, there was a little bit of kind of fresh snow in, and even there were people in front of me. The track was that you really kind of slide through a little bit in with your crampons in the track. And whenever this happens, it's insane up there how much more energy and how much you get out of your rhythm and mentally how exhausting it is when you suddenly have this kind of slide through step, and oh my god, I can tell you, I never thought this is so, can be such a kind of exhausting experience when such a small thing suddenly changes. And then also towards the south summit, there were some passages which were like little bit through the rocks, and again here, like when the difference between having like a nice kind of boot track and the steps are nice and solid and you just can have your rhythm, compared to these kind of loose rocky parts where suddenly you have to make a big step and then you kind of have a small step and you need to really concentrate where you put your front points in, and it's only for like 10 meters, 20 meters. But immediately you get so much slowed down, you lose so much more energy up there. It's insane. And then the conditions from the south summit to the main summit were this year quite dry, and there were quite a lot of rock. Other guides who were there for many years or quite often and guiding it, they told me like it was pretty rocky this year from the conditions, and And for me, was okay because I was really alone there, which was absolutely magical. And I don't know, like I was so lucky that I had this. There were people coming down from the South Summit when I arrived at the South Summit, and then from the South Summit to the main summit and back to the Hillary step. I was completely alone up there. And then afterwards, there were coming some very, very late other shepherds with clients all on oxygen on that day. So there I saw then other people. But being alone with the travels over and back was really like such a gift. I couldn't ask for more, because waiting there for people to move there. I mean, I had it 2019. I turned around because there were so many people, and it's long and really technical in a way for so high. And I was very happy that I just could concentrate on myself and move there over these passages. So there it was quite dry, if you want to say so. But when it wasn't snow, there was at least like a really good trek.
And you use, I've forgotten the name of the little mask you've been wearing for
the air trim.
That's right. The Swedish air trim.
Yeah.
And I've had a number of people ask about the air trim. I've started using them with some cross-country ski racers, 20 years ago in cold conditions when they're training, and even sometimes in races when it's very cold to keep them from burning their lungs. And so why don't you talk a little bit about your experience with those? I think they're very useful.
I mean, I have this stupid cough now, but normally since I used it, I never had this cough, and it makes such a difference. And I think it's so useful. And people always like, now they comment on when they see the picture, "Hey, but you use oxygen." And I'm like, no, this is this kind of air trim mask. And it's this kind of, it creates this. Yeah, like it's a buff deluxe, I always say, which doesn't kind of freezes like right onto your mouth and nose, and it creates this nice hollow space in front of your mouth and nose, and it just makes the air a little bit warmer, a little bit more humid, and that makes all the difference. And you can change these filters for different kind of resistance. And I don't have I have one of the sport filters in there, which is, but I don't feel particular a lot of difference in between the different filters, but just put one of the filters in, and for me it's absolutely, I would never go without one of these masks.
And do you see other people now using them? Because I've had a lot of folks ask me about them in the past few years, since they either saw you or I talked about them in a podcast or an article. But are you seeing more use of them?
Yeah. I mean, I see now a lot of people using them, and I think it's absolutely worth to get one. And for me, it's the combination. I always sleep with the buff on, because for sleeping it's a little bit too uncomfortable and not nice, but I sleep with a buff on over my nose and my mouth, and when I move during the day I have the air trim mask on.
But from what altitude, or do you do it on any cold day regardless of the altitude, or do you normally switch to the air trim at what elevation?
No, I use it really like once I hit the Khumbu, and once I kind of go like Namche Bazaar or higher, I always have one. When I move, I always have my air trim mask on, and I always sleep in the night with my buff. And even here in the Alps in winter, I use now the air trim mask when I do long skimo days or when the air is really cold, and try as well here. I use it also here at home.
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty good, now we're doing a pretty good advertisement for air trim.
I know. And I have to disclaimer, I'm not sponsored by them, and I just buy them online. So I really, this is always, I think, like a good kind of sign that something is really working, and it's okay. You know, it's not, it's not expensive and it's the smart thing and makes a huge difference for sure.
I'll put a link to the, I mean, I don't know, there's only one place in the US that I know that sells them, but I am sure they're available in many other places in Europe. They're
Always tell the people they should go on Google and ask Google to kind of where they get them in their kind of country or location.
Yeah. But I'll put the correct spelling in the show notes so that people can find it. Yeah.
Good. Perfect. So
what were your, again, third experience, first success? I mean, last year, the heat was a big problem. The year before, the crowds were a big problem. This year, the stars aligned and everything worked out very well.
But I have to say, I also learned from my other experiences. And before you said, like, where should we start? And maybe we should just start from the beginning, and which is also a good example where I'm quite happy, also kind of, you know, coming back to what I said before with this comparison, that I did something the start I did completely different. So I couldn't compare how I felt before. Because I didn't win normally, as you know, or the listeners know, maybe from others, I always go to Chukum right away. Then Island Peak is my first kind of acclimatization peak, and I run around there. So I have, we both have all these times, like how fast it takes me going up Island Peak and how fast I go from I don't know, like Namche to Chukum on the second day and this kind of stuff. And this year, lucky me, I decided with my girlfriend that we go first for a nice trekking to Mera Peak, which is from, you go to Lukla and then you go totally the other direction. And I was never on Mera Peak. It's a 6,400 meter high, really easy trekking peak. So we went there. And for me, this was all like a first. So I didn't have any comparison with times, with like how I feel and everything. So this was actually like one of the best things I think I could do because everything was fresh and new. And so this was the start of my expedition, and it couldn't have been better. I mean, going to Mera Peak, the landscape is amazing. I could sleep at 6,400 meters after, I think it was, or no, I went to the top of Mera Peak from the kind of base there on my fifth day after Lukla. So pretty fast and in a way aggressive. But the difference also compared to all the other years was that I was trekking with my girlfriend to Kare, which is the kind of the village on the foot of Mera Peak. And this trekking was really totally like slow and super, super easy. We had long days, long trekking days, but very easy. And this was, in general, a huge difference to compared the last years, where I always was kind of running around in the Khumbu and also getting to Chukum, as you know. And I was wondering if this was one of the kind of actually lessons I learned for next times, that maybe it's, I mean, I'm curious to know your opinion to it. Because on the mountain itself, on Everest, I never have any kind of fast twitch fibers working there because everything is so slow. So if I now train like in the lead up in the acclimatization process and go running around there, where I definitely then use my fast twitch and fibers way more, maybe this is something which is not really beneficial to it. And now I was trekking always super slow, but for long days. And I had this one day where I moved fast up and down Mera Peak in like one push up and down for sure. But compared to the other years, this was the big difference. And then when I was also alone in the Khumbu and my girlfriend left and I was focusing on Everest and going there up and down and being in Feriche, I also never really kind of, you know, I never ran down from a base camp to Feriche. I was just walking fast, but I never had like a running movement because I thought actually I don't feel it in a way. It was more like a feel thing for me this time. And I just wonder in general if this is something you think might be actually like a good thing to change this for the future as well.
Yeah, it's something that I normally recommend to people that we coach and or people that I talk to about this. I believe the acclimatization period should be conducted at an intensity that is ridiculously easy because you're not acclimated and it's very easy to push too hard during the and I think during the acclimatization period and I remember last year when you were there by yourself getting ready for Killian to arrive, one day you were feeling super good and you decided to go do some hill sprints. And yeah. I remember we talked right after that and you went, oh my God, I think I might have ruined my trip. And you just one little workout for an hour that normally you would do at home and not have any problem with kind of trashed you, put you, or you were worried it kind of pushed you over the edge. Luckily, you managed to recover, you know, it took several days though to recover from that. And I had this similar experience one time with Steve in Tibet. And we were trekking into a base camp and Steve got really sick on this on one particular day. And it was raining and nasty. We were down still low elevation. And I said to Steve, hey, you know, you can't carry that pack, you know, just let's drop your pack here. And we'll, you know, I'll go ahead. We'll go ahead and I'll come back and get your pack. And we weren't even at a particularly high elevation, you know, maybe, 4,500 meters, something like that. And so we went to the camp. I set up the tent, got Steve inside the tent and I ran back to get his pack. And then really hurried to get back so I could, you know, get out of the rain and maybe, you know, start helping him. And I was trashed for like 4 days after that. And so that made me, and I had a similar experience with other people, let's say on Denali, where, you know, I was with people who were not as fit as I was. And we were, I was on the West Buttress route. We were going to climb the upper part of the West Rib. And, I thought we were going easy and it turned out that they were like in zone three, you know, pushing really hard to keep up. And I didn't realize this. And they, that one particular one day getting to 14,000 feet when it seemed like an easy day to me, completely pushed them over the edge and they were destroyed. And we actually had to go down. They couldn't continue. So those two experiences have really stood out to me about how important it is to take it very easy. And easy is relative, of course. Like that day on Denali was easy for me, but it was, you know, way too hard for these other people. And, you know, in the past, when you have been over there, I've just kind of thought, oh, well, David knows what easy feels like. And so, but now we, now you really know what easy feels like over there. You know, an easy at 6,000 meters is different than easy at sea level. I mean, you have to kind of, you know, adopt a whole new kind of mentality of how hard to push yourself. And my theory, and I have no basis scientifically for this, but my theory is that when you push yourself up out of this aerobic zone, even a little bit, that I'm not sure it has a lot to do. Well, maybe it does have to do somewhat with the fast twitch fibers. I think it's more the fact that, you know, you're somewhat hypoxic in that environment. And so you're going to be producing more lactate, even at low intensities. And, you know, that's why I think what the mistake that people make when they're thinking about training for high altitude, you know, I often get this, people say, well, I know I'm going to be breathing really hard and my legs are going to be really tired at altitude and I can't move. So I better do a lot of hard interval training, you know, high intensity training down at sea level or at low elevation where I live. And I said, yes, it feels like that at 7,000 meters, but it's not the same thing because you're not moving very fast. So it's like you don't need that high intensity training, except for what, this is something I want to touch on too, is the ventilation training that you have been doing that I think has been helpful. But going back to this real quickly, I think there's just not enough oxygen to support high intensity work, but the physiologically, it's having a similar effect in terms of, I think, producing lactate. That's why your legs get so heavy and burning and you're breathing hard. Mm-hmm. So I just feel like we have to scale way down in terms of our sort of even our just our feeling about the intensity, let alone the heart rate and all that. And I know that when, let's say, you know, it's very common for cross-country skiers in the summer or in the early part of the fall before there's much snow at low elevations to go to have high elevation training camps on glaciers or in places where there is like early snow in October, November. And usually those are at high elevations. And they're coming usually from a place with low, they're training all summer at relatively low elevations. And when they go to those high elevation training camps, whether it's in July or in November, they have to reduce their training intensity. You know, the zone one and zone two and all that moves down 10 beats at least. Because if you go take the same heart rate zones from sea level to, let's say, you know, 2000 meters and start training there, within a few days or a week, you're going to be exhausted. So I learned that lesson in both these areas. So I wish I knew exactly what was going on physiologically. Maybe somebody does and they can, you know, write into us and tell us what's happening. Mm-hmm. But certainly my experience is, and now you're verifying this again, even for someone as fit as you and as fast as you, that taking it super easy during the acclimatization period, I think pays enormous benefits.
I agree. And the thing with, I had this time the feeling that I was somehow really altitude efficient. Like my body was, I didn't had this kind of feeling of incredible strength in a way, which I had some years before, which I think was at some points it was a little bit scary to me that I didn't feel this kind of, you know, this kind of sixth gear and have this strength like uphill and I can just like bang push. But somehow I had the feeling my body was so much more efficient with using the little oxygen there is. And also on the summit day, for example, the difference between 2019 was really significant in the way that I felt so less kind of like mentally and cognitive kind of affected by the altitude. I was way more kind of present, if you want to say so. I felt really like 2019, I was really surprised like how kind of difficult it is to concentrate, how difficult I really needed kind of to get all my thoughts kind of together and force myself to think like what's the next kind of step and where. And this year I was kind of in a flow state up there really. And I was totally like, also when I see my recordings from up there with my camera, my sentences are really normal in a way and don't lag any kind of, I have other recordings from a broad peak, for example, where we have sentences where everybody thinks like what the heck, they're totally kind of gaga and what they talk about. So but and there I was alone and I was like totally present in a way, and I was always really okay, do I make it from here to there and back, like what how do I feel, let's check with myself and all this kind of stuff. So I had the feeling for some reason, and I maybe kind of put it back. One theory is that I just like through all this kind of slow tracking and never really pushing myself like crazy in a fast movement mode, that my muscles and my body was just so much better trained to work exactly in this kind of pace, which then up there is the one you have. You know, it's not that that I needed to move fast, which of course is sometimes way more fun to move a little bit faster, and you run down and you jump and where, but in the end up there, it won't happen and you don't need it there. So yeah, that's my theory.
Well, theory or not, we know it works. That's, I think, what's important. Yeah.
That worked this year for sure. And yeah, I said, for me, the summit day was incredible because I was alone there, and it was, it's really, I think, such a rare occasion that you get this weather, like almost no wind, you're up there alone, and the way down was for sure hard, and I experienced this kind of, you know, like I walked 10 steps down, then I sit down, and then I kind of was breathing, and then I was kind of forcing myself and saying, like, okay, come on, do another 10 steps, and you kind of really slowly fight your way back there. But I went to camp 4 after the summit. Then I did a 3-hour break there in camp 4, melted some snow, drunk something. And I didn't have my sleeping bag in camp 4 because I left it in camp 3 because the day before, like going to the South Col, I knew I would arrive there midday and then I wait until the evening and then I start. So I don't need my sleeping bag up there. So on the way back, this also was a good motivation to get down to camp 3. And the lower you get down, the better it is. So I then walked and started in the late afternoon, going down from then after the summit, camp 4, and then arriving pretty late in camp 3. But then it's kind of, you just like move and you just do your thing. So then I slept in camp 3, and then the next day I went back down to base camp.
Can we talk a little bit about your the use of the Hypoxico training you've been doing, and if you're finding that do you think that's been helpful? It seems like it has in these past few years. So, and I think it's different than the kind of use of Hypoxico that most people are using, which is to sleep in a simulated high altitude atmosphere. But so do you want to give us a little idea of what you've been doing and how you're using that?
Yeah, I mean, I we figured for us out, or that for me it works the best when I'm here in Spain, I use it just as like an intermittent kind of training method. So that means like I go on the treadmill and run for an hour with the Hypoxico system and just train with that, like my breathing muscles, and that's the main kind of benefit. Sleeping in it, I tried a couple of years ago, and we saw that for me it just sabotaged my recovery, and so I don't, and I would then need to dial back with my normal training, which for me I think it's more beneficial to train properly when I'm here. So that's the only case where I use the Hypoxico when I'm here in Spain at sea level, and then I do this intermittent training. On the other hand, I have to be honest and fair that in Chamonix, I use the natural altitude there to get like a pre-acclimatization. Like this time, I slept a lot of nights in huts which are like 3,400, 3,600. And I tried during the day move around 4,000 meters, go climbing there on a Mont Blanc de Tacul or on Breithorn in the Monte Rosa Massif. So that's kind of replaces my Hypoxico training, where maybe others who don't have the mountains close, like I have there in winter, they then sleep maybe in the tent. But I think, yeah, like again, everybody has to be aware that it takes something out and it sabotages in a way your training and or your recovery, and you need to take this into account.
Yeah, it certainly is a delicate balance, I think, terms of recovery when you're starting to sleep at high altitude, whether it's natural altitude or, you know, a artificial altitude. But I think that I'd like to expand just a little bit on this use of the intermittent hypoxic training to explain to people who aren't familiar with it. And so David's saying that, you know, he's running on a treadmill at sea level, breathing a hypoxic air mixture from the hypoxico generator that he has next to a treadmill. And we started playing around with this just a few years ago, and the initial feedback I got from him was that it seemed like when he arrived at altitude, it helped, and it seemed to help with maybe not acclimatization, but just the effort of moving at altitude. And my theory, again, with no science to back this up, and really you being the only person that I know that has used this idea, although I think Killian has used it as well. But my theory is that it conditions the breathing muscles, like David just mentioned, conditions those breathing muscles so that they become fitter in a way. But the only way you could condition those breathing muscles in the same way, because you'd be breathing a lot harder, breathing a hypoxic mixture than you would a normal sea level air mixture at whatever intensity. You could do this by doing hard interval training at sea level and get the same sort of training effect for your breathing muscles, but then you would also get a big global fatigue load from that type of high intensity hard training. And as David's pointed out, you don't really need that kind of high intensity training for 8,000 meter climbing, because you just can't move anywhere near that sort of speed. And my theory again being that, okay, this gives the same sort of aerobic benefits to those breathing muscles, which from what I've read can consume about 20% of the total blood volume during hard work. And if those muscles are more aerobically capable, just like we're training your leg muscles to be, then they're going to be, you know, they're going to be fitter. They're going to be able to work harder for longer with less fatigue. And, you know, and breathing as for people who haven't been at these extremely high elevations, it's a lot of work to breathe. And so if we can do anything to improve the efficiency or just, like I said, the fitness of those breathing muscles, it seems to pay off. So again, maybe somebody will do a study on this and tell us we're full of shit and it doesn't work at all.
Maybe, but another kind of totally only anecdotal, anecdotal kind of similar experience is when I lived in Munich, I was swimming a lot and I had the feeling going to an 8,000 meter peak with a lot of swimming, like pool swimming and doing breathing pyramids. And you come from swimming, you have a swimming background as well, Scott. So I had the feeling that this is also something which really helped me. And I felt really good on these expeditions where I did a lot of had a lot of pool time. And I think it's the same effect maybe in a way, and maybe for people who don't have the hypoxico generator, but they have a pool very close by, this could be a good way to experiment. And swimming in general, it's a good like recovery activity, but there you train as well, really well, your whole breathing muscles. And I think, has a pretty similar benefit to it.
Yeah. Especially if you're capable, if you're a decent swimmer and you can do, like you said, breathing pyramids, where maybe you start off with one length of the pool, you breathe, you know, every stroke or every other stroke, and only be able to breathe always on your right side. And then the next length you breathe every two strokes, and then the next length you breathe every three strokes. And of course, if you can do flip turns, then you have to hold your breath each flip turn. And so you are really training those muscles with kind of a hypoxic stimulus.
I remember I did this kind of 3-5-7-5-3 kind of breathing pyramid kind of, and this every seventh stroke for like two lanes, the first time I did it, I was like drowning more or less.
And then over, you're
gonna die. I was like, oh my God, I will die. And then over time, over the kind of, training cycle, suddenly I could do it. And this is, like I think you must train really well your whole breathing muscles and how your body really operates also under this kind of lack of oxygen or limited oxygen, and this all benefits as well for altitude.
Well, I'm gonna have to leave soon because my wife's putting on a race today and I have to go help out. But before
Damn,
that happens,
that's good.
Before that happens, I want to talk a little bit about what you normally do after an expedition, like how much you rest and what you're doing during this recovery period, because I think there's a lot of misunderstanding. A lot of people think, oh, I got to jump right back into training immediately really hard or whatever. But what's your plan now and what's your normal approach?
Well, our normal agenda is always I come back from an expedition and then we have this at least 2 weeks where we don't put anything in the calendar and we don't plan anything. And in these weeks, I still go on a run. I do activities, but I don't have any kind of numbers to kind of hit. And especially now I feel for sure more fatigued than I normally felt after, especially the expedition where I don't make it to the summit. And so now for sure I will take it easy, but I still try to slowly move and to really ease very kind of gentle into, for example, running and stuff like this. And maybe I will start a little bit with the road bike because it's a little bit easier on the body. But for sure it's super important to take your time and don't kind of start right away.
And I often suggest to people that they do the kind of activities that they enjoy that maybe they had to sacrifice and give up while they were in a really strict training program before whatever the big event is, Everest or some big race, and I often did this with the skiers that I was coaching at the end of the ski season. They should take a month and go surfing and kayaking and rock climbing and all these things that they were not able to do while they're training, but that they enjoy, still being active, but not with the focus is not on training. The focus is more on recreation. And I think you need a mental break, especially after something, as stressful as what you just did. It required a great deal of mental effort. And I think you kind of need to give that your nervous system a little bit of a chance to recover too. And so I believe it's really important to have this kind of recreation period.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, I lost now 6 kilos. So I am, which is 10% or something like this. So quite, I think I was never so thin after an expedition, or for only very rarely that is like this. So definitely there you see that it was quite challenging and I lost some substance. And so for sure there, I think this will be probably kind of the first things when we start again that we kind of see where and what we do to prevent any damage and kind of then ramping up too much intensity, which can it's very tempting to then go too much running, too much training right away. So I think we need to be smart on that.
I think strength, I like to start back with some strength training. You've lost muscle mass. So I think rebuilding some strength is a great way to get to try to dip your toe back into training without going out and feeling the need to run, 60, 70 kilometers a week or something like that. And I think that's another thing I want to point out to folks that the bulk of David's training is done running. And I believe that there's, even and we have, this is another whole nother podcast I don't have time for right now, but we should talk about the year that you trained for the marathon.
And just saying, like, I'm a little bit playing with the idea that we may be repeat that one.
Okay.
But there's another one. Like we
should
said,
should we give Eliud Kipchoge a warning that you're coming in for him on another marathon? but I mean to sort of tantalize people about our next, we should talk about your marathon training and how it worked for you. We found that the year that David trained for a marathon and had a great race, it really carried over well into the mountains for you that next season. And I think that's
very well.
Something I want to emphasize, that, you know, one of the reasons we push running so much, you know, obviously there are certain people who can't run, age, injury, that sort of thing. So it's not suitable for everyone, but we have just found that running is an incredibly useful tool for mountaineers, climbers, and, you know, obviously for runners, but the transfer of the training effect over to mountain sports is tremendous. And so if you can learn to be a runner, it's a great thing.
And it's fun, and it's good to move to move in the mountains with a running movement.
So, well, any parting words, last thoughts for people?
Well, I mean, I just want to thank Upper Athletes for this kind of, like, incredible years of training and preparation. And now finally it kind of pays off. And I think the platform you created here, it's so amazing, the wisdom people can find here. And I feel this more and more when I moved the last two months in Nepal and on Everest. So many times I had people coming up to me and say, like, "Hey, you are David. I was listening to a podcast and I know you from Upper Athlete." And this was really it's so cool to see the folks out there who are moving in the mountains are now, so many of them are kind of have ties and to Upper Athlete, have like gained knowledge, and so I just want to say a huge and big thank you to you, to kind of believing in me for all these years and giving me your wisdom and your coaching and your guidance, and in general to Upper Athletes, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you, that's very nice to hear. It's certainly been Steve's and my intention all along to not create this platform to dispense this as much knowledge as we hopefully can, but also to create a community of people who share the same interests. And so, like, they can come to you and they say, "Hey, you're David. I know who you are." And so that's great. I'm pleased with that. I'm really pleased with that.
And it's a good and great community already, and it will just grow.
Yeah. So super. Well, thanks a lot, David. And maybe we should start thinking about this marathon idea.
Let's give it like a week or so of a thought, and then we kind of connect back.
Okay.
Perfect.
All right.
Thank you, Scott. Bye.
Thanks for taking the time. See you. Bye.
Thanks for joining us today. For more information about what we do, please go to our website, uphillathlete.com.